and this teenaged old woman, this rather beautiful girl who had loved my grandfather when he was the age I am now. There was nothing I could do but put my arms around her too, so I did, and after a while, I guess we were both crying. I heard her take a deep breath in the dark, and then she broke away. The fire flared back to life in her hand.
"Sorry about that," she said. "I'm not usually so..."
"Don't worry about it.
We should be getting on."
"Lead the way," I said. We walked through the woods in a comfortable silence. When we came to the bog, she said,
"Step only where I step,"
and I did, planting my feet in her prints. Bog gases flared up in green pyres in the distance, as if in sympathy with Emma's light. We reached the cairn and ducked inside, shuffling in single file to the rear chamber and then out again to a world shrouded in mist. She guided me back to the path, and when we reached it, she laced her fingers through mine and squeezed. We were quiet for a moment. Then she turned and went back, the fog swallowing her so quickly that for a moment I wondered if she'd been there at all. Returning to town, I half expected to find horse-drawn wagons roaming the streets. Instead, I was welcomed by the hum of generators and the glow of TV screens behind cottage windows. I was home, such as it was. Kev was manning the bar again and raised a glass in my direction as I came in. None of the men in the pub offered to lynch me. All seemed right with the world. I went upstairs to find Dad asleep in front of his laptop at our little table. When I shut the door, he woke with a start.
"Hi, hey, you're out late. Or are you? What time is it?"
"I don't know," I said. "Before 9, I think. The Jennies are still on." He stretched and rubbed his eyes.
"What'd you do today? I was hoping I'd see you for dinner."
"Just explored the old house some more."
"Find anything good?"
Not really," I said, realizing that I probably should have bothered to concoct a more elaborate cover story. He looked at me strangely.
"Where do you get those?"
"Get what?"
"Your clothes," he said.
I looked down and realized I'd completely forgotten about the tweed pants and suspenders outfit I was wearing.
"I found them in the house," I said, because I didn't have time to think of a less weird answer. "Aren't they cool?"
He grimaced.
"You put on clothes that you found?
Jake, that's unsanitary. And what happened to your jeans and jacket?" I needed to change the subject.
"They got super dirty, so I
trailed off, making a point of noticing the document on his computer screen.
"Whoa, is that your book? How's it coming?"
He slapped the laptop shut.
"My book isn't the issue right now. What's important is our time here be therapeutic for you. I'm not sure that spending your days alone in that old house is really what Dr. Golan had in mind when he green-lighted this trip."
"Wow, I think that was the record," I said.
"What?"
"The longest streak ever of you not mentioning my psychiatrist." I pretended to look at a non-existent wristwatch. 4 days, 5 hours, and 26 minutes. I sighed.
"It was good while it lasted."
"That man has been a great help to you," he said. "God only knows the state you'd be in right now if we hadn't found him."
"You're right, Dad. Dr. Golan did help me, but that doesn't mean he has to control every aspect of my life. I mean, Jesus, you and Mom might as well buy me one of those little bracelets that says, 'What would Golan do?' That way I can ask myself before I do anything, before I take a dump. How would Dr. Golan want me to take this dump? Should I bank it off the side or go straight down the middle? What would be the most psychologically beneficial dump I could take?"
Dad didn't say anything for a few seconds, and when he did, his voice was all low and gravelly. He told me I was going birding with him the next day whether I liked it or not. When I replied that he was sadly mistaken, he got up and went downstairs to the pub. I thought he'd be drinking or something,
so I went to change out of my clown clothes. But a few minutes later, he knocked at my bedroom door and said there was someone on the phone for me. I figured it was Mom, so I gritted my teeth and followed him downstairs to the phone booth in the far corner of the pub. He handed me the receiver and went to sit at a table. I slid the door closed. "Hello?" "I just spoke to your father," a man said. He sounded a little upset. It was Dr. Golan. I wanted to say that he and my dad could both stuff it up their asses, but I knew the situation required some tact. If I pissed Golan off now, it would be the end of my trip. I couldn't leave yet, not with so much more to learn about the peculiar children. So I played along and explained what I'd been up to, all except the kids in a time loop part, and tried to make it sound like I was coming around to the idea that there was nothing special about the island or my grandfather. It was like a mini-session over the phone. "I hope you're not just telling me what I want to hear," he said. That had become his standard line. "Maybe I should come out there and check on you. I could use a little vacation. How does that sound?" "Please be joking," I prayed. "I'm okay, really," I said. "Relax, Jacob. I'm only kidding. Though Lord knows I could use some time away from the office. And actually, I believe you. You do sound okay. In fact, just now I told your father that probably the best thing he could do is to give you a little breathing room and let you sort things out on your own." "Really? You've had your parents and me hovering over you for so long. At a certain point, it becomes counterproductive." "Well, I really appreciate that." He said something else I couldn't quite hear. There was a lot of noise on his end. "It's hard to hear you," I said. "Are you in a mall or something?" "The airport," he replied, "picking up my sister. Anyway, all I said was to enjoy yourself, explore, and don't worry too much. I'll see you soon, all right? Thanks again, Dr. G." As I hung up the phone, I felt bad for having ragged on him earlier. That was twice now he'd stuck up for me when my own parents wouldn't. My dad was nursing a beer across the room. I stopped by his table on my way upstairs. "About tomorrow," I said.
"Do what you want, I guess."
"Are you sure?" He shrugged sullenly.
"Doctor's orders."
"I'll be home for dinner. Promise." He just nodded. I left him in the bar and went up to bed. Falling asleep, my thoughts drifted to the peculiar children and the first question they'd asked after Miss Peregrine had introduced me. "Is Jacob going to stay with us?" At the time, I'd thought, of course not. But why not? If I never went home, what exactly would I be missing? I pictured my cold, cavernous house, my friendless town full of bad memories, the utterly unremarkable life that had been mapped out for me. It had never once occurred to me, I realized, to refuse it.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children by Ransom Riggs. Chapter 7. Morning brought rain and wind and fog, pessimistic weather that made it hard to believe the previous day had been anything more than a strange and wonderful dream. I wolfed down my breakfast and told my dad I was going out. He looked at me like I was nuts.
"In this? To do what?"
"To hang out with," I started, without thinking. Then, to cover my tracks, I pretended to have a piece of food stuck in my throat. But it was too late. He'd heard me.
"Hang out with who? Not those rapper hoodlums, I hope."
The only way to get out of this hole was to dig deeper.
"No, you've probably never seen them. They live on the other side of, the island and..."
"Really? I didn't think anyone lived over there." Yeah, well, just a few people, like sheep tenders and whatnot. Anyway, they're cool. They watch my back while I'm at the house.
Friends and safety. Two things my dad couldn't possibly object to.
I want to meet them, he said, trying to look stern.
He often put on this face in imitation of the sensible, no-nonsense dad I think he aspired to be.
Sure thing. We're meeting up over there, though, so another time.
He nodded and took another bite of his breakfast.
Be back by dinner, he said.
Roger, Wilco, Dad.
I practically raced to the bog as I picked my way through a shifting muck, trying to remember the route of semi-invisible grass islands Emma had used to cross it. I worried that all I would find on the other side was more rain and a ruined house. So it was with great relief that I emerged from the cairn to find September 3rd, 1940, just as I'd left it. The day warm and sunny and fogless. The sky a dependable blue, clouds forming shapes that seemed comfortably familiar. Even better, Emma was there waiting for me, sitting on the edge of the mound casting stones into the bog.
About time, she cried, jumping to her feet. Come on, everyone's waiting for you.
They are?
Yes, she said with an impatient eye roll, taking my hand and pulling me after her.
I sparked with excitement, not only at her touch, but at the thought of the day that lay ahead, full of endless possibility. Though in a million superficial ways it would be identical to the day before, the same breeze would blow and the same tree limbs would fall, my experience of it would be new. So would the peculiar children's. They were the gods of this strange little heaven, and I was their guest. We dashed across the bog and through the forest as if late for an appointment. When we reached the house, Emma led me around to the backyard, where a small wooden stage had been erected. Kids were bustling in and out of the house, carrying props, buttoning up suit jackets, and zipping into sequin dresses. Warming up was a little orchestra, made up of just an accordion, a battered trombone, and a musical saw that Horace played with a bow.
What's this? I asked Emma. Are you guys putting on a play?
You'll see, she said.
Who's in it?
You'll see.
What's it about?
She pinched me. A whistle blew, and everyone ran to claim seats in a row of folding chairs that faced the stage. Emma and I sat down just as the curtain opened, revealing a straw boater hat floating atop a gaudy red and white striped suit. It was only when I heard a voice did I realize that, of course, it was Millard.
Ladies and gentlemen, he crowed. It gives me the utmost pleasure to present you a performance like no other in history. A show of such unrivaled daring, of such accomplished magicianship, that you simply won't believe your eyes. Good citizens, I give you Miss Peregrine and her peculiar children.
The audience burst into an uproarious applause. Millard tipped his hat.
For our first illusion, I will produce Miss Peregrine herself.
He ducked behind the curtain and emerged a moment later, a folded sheet draped over one arm and a peregrine falcon perched on the other. He nodded to the orchestra, which lurched into a kind of wheezing carnival music. Emma elbowed me.
Watch this, she whispered.
Millard set the falcon down and held the sheet in front, screening the bird from the audience. He began counting backward.
3, 2, 1.
On one, I heard the unmistakable flap of wings and then saw Miss Peregrine's head, her human head, pop up from behind the sheet to even more uproarious applause. Her hair was mussed, and I could only see her from the shoulders up. She seemed to be naked behind the sheet. Apparently, when you change into a bird, your clothes don't go along for the ride.
Taking the edges of the sheet, she wrapped it chastely around herself.
"Mr. Portman," she said, peering down at me from the stage, "I'm so happy you've returned. This is a little exhibition we used to tour around the continent back in the Halcyon days. I thought you might find it instructive."
And then she swept off stage in a flourish, heading into the house to retrieve her clothes. One after another, the peculiar children came out of the audience and took the stage, each with an act of their own. Millard removed his tuxedo so that he was completely invisible and juggled glass bottles. Olive removed her leaden shoes and performed a gravity-defying gymnastics routine on a set of parallel bars. Emma made fire, swallowed it, then blew it out again without burning herself. I applauded until I thought my hands would blister. When Emma returned to her seat, I turned to her and said, "I don't understand. You performed this for people?"
"Of course," she replied.
"Normal people?"
"Of course, normal people. Why would peculiars pay to see things they can do themselves?
But wouldn't this, like, blow your cover?" She chuckled.
"Nobody suspected a thing," she said. "People come to sideshows to see stunts and tricks and what all, and as far as anybody knew, that's exactly what we showed them."
"So you were hiding in plain sight?"
"Used to be the way most peculiars made a living," she said.
"And no one ever caught on?
Once in a while we'd get some knobhead backstage asking nosy questions, which is why there'd always be a strong arm on hand to toss them out on their bums. Speak of the devil, here she is now."
Up on stage, a mannish-looking girl was dragging a boulder the size of a small refrigerator out from behind the curtain.
"She may not be the sharpest tool in the woodshed," Emma whispered, "but she's got a massive heart, and she'd go to the grave for her mates. We're thick as thieves, Bronwyn and me."
Someone had passed around a stack of promotional cards Miss Peregrine had used to advertise their act. It reached me with Bronwyn's card on top. In her picture, she stood barefoot, challenging the camera with an icy stare. Emblazoned across the back was "The Amazing Strong Girl of Swansea." "Why isn't she lifting a boulder if that's what she does on stage?" I asked.
"She was in a foul mood because the bird made her dress like a lady for the picture. She refused to lift so much as a hat box."
"Looks like she drew the line at wearing shoes, too."
"She generally does."
Bronwyn finished dragging the rock to the middle of the stage, and for an awkward moment, she just stared into the crowd, as if someone had told her to pause for dramatic effect. Then she bent down and gripped the rock between her big hands and slowly lifted it above her head. Everyone clapped and hooted, the kids' enthusiasm undimmed, though they'd probably seen her do this trick 1,000 times. It was almost like being at a pep rally for a school I didn't attend. Bronwyn yawned and walked off with the boulder tucked under one arm. Then the wild-haired girl took the stage. Her name was Fiona, Emma said. She stood facing the crowd behind a planter filled with dirt, her hands raised above it like a conductor. The orchestra began to play "Flight of the Bumblebee," as well as they could, anyway, and Fiona pawed the air above the planter, her face contorted in effort and concentration. As the song crescendoed, a row of daisies poked up from the dirt and unfurled toward her hands. It was like one of those fast-motion videos of plants blooming, except she seemed to be reeling the flowers up from their loamy bed by invisible strings. The kids ate it up, jumping out of their seats to cheer her on. Emma flipped through the stack of postcards to Fiona's.
"Her card's my favorite," she said. "We worked for days on her costume."
I looked at it. She was dressed like a beggar girl and stood holding a chicken. "What's she supposed to be?" I asked. "A homeless farmer?" Emma pinched me.
"She's meant to look natural. Like a savage-type person. Jill of the Jungle, we called her."
"Is she really from the jungle?"
She's from Ireland.
Are there a lot of chickens in the jungle? She pinched me again. While we'd been whispering, Hugh had joined Fiona on stage. He stood with his